When I was about 5 years old, one morning I was sitting in the kitchen with my mother. We were having breakfast together. In this tiny little kitchen that we had, everything was sort of crammed right there, and the toaster was right by my mom, and it was radiating heat, and so she said to me, just as a comment, she said, "You should touch that toaster. It is really hot." So I did. I was 5 years old, and I reached out my sweet little pinky, and I popped it right on that toaster, and the next thing I knew, I was shrieking. I had pain. My mother was absolutely beside herself. She immediately works to try to take my pain away. I said, "Oh, I didn't mean for you really to do that. I was just talking about how hot it was." Well, I'll tell you, from that day till this, I never touch a toaster in the morning. They're hot, and I'm not going to waste my pain. Probably wasn't too long after that that my mom happened to be outside of the house. I was there by myself, but she was just out for a moment. It wasn't like she was gone for any length of time, but I was in the living room, and we had half a television set in those days. They were called radios, and that was taking care of me while Mom was taking care of something just outside the house. Well, while she was just outside the house, I got a little curious, and I happened to notice across the living room from me, there was a lamp, one of these multi-bulb lamps with a bulb not in one of the sockets. And I began to wonder, what would happen if I put my finger in that socket? So, I did. And immediately, I received a jolt, a shock, and as I picked myself up off the other side of the room, I decided that from that moment till now, I'll never put my finger in another socket. I was not going to waste my pain. Several years later, now married, one or two children, I went to my doctor for my annual physical. And the first thing he said to me as I walked into his office was, "What's that protrusion in your throat?" Now, in case you don't know, protrusions in your throat do not happen to be a good thing. So he sticks his hands around me like this and says, "Swallow." That's an idiotic thing to say when a man is choking you to death. But at any rate, we determined beyond that primitive form of test with a CAT scan that I have what could be potentially a pre-malignant nodule on my thyroid, and it would have to come out. So I went into the hospital, had my surgery. They took away half my thyroid. And my surgeon said to me, "Now, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go on thyroid, because if you go on thyroid, it'll dry up your gland, and you won't have any problems, but you'll still have a thyroid just in case. And if you don't do it, these things tend to come back, so you could be back again for surgery." Well, I didn't want to go on pills. I don't like being dependent on pills. So I just decided that I would not go on thyroid. Well, in the meantime, we moved here, and my doctor here said, "Well, you know, you've had that surgery, and you still have half a thyroid, and these things do tend to come back, so we should just do a CAT scan just in case." So I went over to Baylor, and they're clicking away, and I knew what was happening. I mean, I knew what happened the first time. I knew when they stopped. I knew when they focused. I knew what was going on. So they stopped. They focused. Click, 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 click. Well, he calls me up a few days later and says, "You need to have surgery." And so I did. And now I don't have a thyroid, and now I take pills every day. You know what I did? I wasted my pain. Isn't it interesting how in so much of life we don't waste our pain, but how so often in life we do? I think that's one of the single biggest mistakes we make when it comes to sin. We sin, we suffer, and then we turn around and waste our pain. We go right back and do the same thing again, and we sin, and we suffer, and we turn around and waste our pain. Over these last few weeks, we have been looking at what happens when we have to go back from sin to God. What are some steps we can face when we have to deal with the reality that sin has taken us away from God and we have to go back? One of the biggest realities we have to face in the total context of our study these days is that our sin patterns become our family patterns. And that means that our sin pain becomes our family's pain. And if that's been true in our lives, and there are three R's we need to remember. We've looked at the first two of the three R's. The first R was return to God where you saw Him last. We saw this in the life of Abraham. He decided he would not trust God. He decided he would rely on his own resources. He got into trouble. He went down into Egypt instead of trusting God. He came out rich, but he came out rejected because Pharaoh caught him in a lie. What was a half-truth? It was just a whole lie. And Pharaoh caught him and escorted him out of the country, and God, and Abraham went back to the place where he had last been with God, where he had last trusted God, and where he had last committed to God. And there he went back and proclaimed the name of the Lord, reaffirming his commitment to God at that point in time. And that's the first step on the way back from sin to God. Go back to the last place where you and God were together. Build an altar of confession, cleansing. Find that forgiveness. But then we saw a second factor. Because one of the key problems with sin is that it doesn't stop bearing fruit even though we've stopped producing sin. Sin has a way of getting started and it just keeps right on going with its results. We can't stop the results, though we can gain forgiveness for the responsibility. And so the second R is this. Realize that your past sin will impact your present life. It's not true of all sin, but it is true of much of the sin, particularly some of the significant patterns of sin that we've had on and on and on in our lives. The patterns of independence and the patterns of lying, or the patterns of deceiving, or the patterns of trusting money more than God. Those patterns, once they're let loose, even if we stop them, they still bear their fruit. And so Abram found himself in strife with one whom he loved, his nephew, Lot. And they had to divide. And because Abram didn't obey God in the first place by leaving Lot back where he had come from in God's will, and because Abram didn't obey God in the second place by staying where God wanted him to be, and he took Lot with him, as a result, now Lot comes out the victim of easy money. And Abram had to realize past sin impacts present life. Now this morning we're ready for our third R. We're ready for our third R. And this is in a somewhat strange chapter, I suppose, Genesis chapter 14. This is a chapter full of strange names and hard to locate places, and if you ever get there, they're not worth going there for. An ancient battle that means nothing. It wasn't even a blip on the oscilloscope of history. It's absolutely nothing in terms of political, historical conflict. It means nothing. Four kings went to war against five. And the names are all strange, and we stumble over the names. We stumble over the names of the kings. We stumble over the names of the places. These ancient four kings came from Iraq. Four kings came from Iraq, and the ancient five kings against whom they went to war came from the eastern side of the Jordan River down into the southern and southeastern segment of the Holy Land below the Dead Sea. These are obscure places even today. But there's a lesson here. There's a profound lesson here. And there's a third R that will make all the difference in our lives. I want to begin with the observation that in the first 16 verses of this chapter, Abraham has to take a risk because of his past sin. There was a group of five ancient kings who had been forced into subjection by another group of four ancient kings. For 12 years they had paid them tribute, in the 13th year they refused to, and in the 14th year the four came against the five. And that's what we read about. Let's begin in chapter 14 and verse 1. And it came about in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, that's ancient Babylon, Arioch, king of Eleazar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goyim. Now those are fun names, aren't they? There were a bunch of kings that came from strange places. They made war with Bera, king of Sodom, and with Birsha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, Shemember, king of Zebuim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar. All these came as allies in the valley of Siddim. That's in a valley immediately south of the Dead Sea. 12 years they had served Chedorlaomer, but the 13th year they rebelled, and in the 14th year Chedorlaomer and the kings that were with him came out and defeated the Rephaim and a number of other groups along the eastern side of the Jordan River. And then they turned back and they came up from now from the southwest, coming directly just south of the Dead Sea and its ancient limitations. And they conquered all the country of the Amalekites in verse 7 and the Amorites, those who lived in Hazeron Tamar. The king of Sodom and the king of Gomorrah and the king of Admah and the king of Zeboim and the king of Bela, that is Zoar, came out. And they arrayed for battle against them in the valley of Shittim against Chedorlaomer, king of... They don't want you to miss the number of these kings here, do they? At the end of verse 9, 4 kings against 5. There are the odds. The odds are 4 to 5. Fascinating that they use the under instead of the over to present the odds. 4 to 5. The whole idea, I think, is to emphasize the fact that there were only 4 who came from the east, and there were 5 local kings. Now, the valley of Siddim was full of tar pits, bitumen. In fact, the ancient Romans called the Dead Sea by a Latin term for asphalt. It was so full of bitumen. And apparently, this was so valuable to these eastern kings because in their building projects, they came over to that part of the world and got it. And they built buildings and so forth as a result. Now, what's very interesting is that the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled, and they fell into them. Those who survived fled to the hill country. And these conquering kings took all of the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their food supply, and they departed. Now you say, wait a minute. It's 11 useless verses. I mean, come on. Even the Bereans, who in Acts are ahead of the rest because they checked Paul out. Even the Bereans can't handle 11 useless verses. Here we're talking about the sweep of God's movement. Here we're talking about one of the most significant and strategic men in all of the Bible, this man Abraham. Here we are getting into the realities of his marriage, and we're looking at the tensions and the dynamics between Abraham and Sarah, and we're learning things about our own lives, both married and single. Here we are learning from this man, and in the middle of the whole thing, God gets us bogged down in bitumen pits in the valley of Siddim. Not even he ought to be there. What are we doing stuck in these pits? Look at verse 12. And they also took Lot, Abram's nephew, and his possessions, and departed, for he was living in Sodom. Easy money comes with a high price. Lot had been brought against God's will by Abraham from his roots to the promised land. Lot had been taken down into Egypt where Abraham had gotten rich, and Lot, just as the tag along, just as the kid nephew, just as the one who was happened to be with Abraham, he ends up getting rich. It was easy money for him. He had come into everything through Abraham. He'd not gotten his wealth on his own, but through his uncle. And like so many Christians who focus on money, Lot was attracted to the good life rather than the godly life. In the previous chapter, when he and Abraham had come into conflict, their herdsmen had come into conflict over available grazing land for their herds, Abraham had stepped in and said, let's not get into a fight over this. I'll tell you what, take whatever you want. Now, the land was actually Abraham's from God, but he said to his nephew, take whatever you want. So they went up to a high place where they could look, and Lot looked all around the Jordan Valley. He looked down to the south and he saw Sodom, and in those days, Sodom and Gomorrah were two of the most fertile and beautiful parts of the entire Jordan Valley. And he says, I'll take that. And he departed and he moved his tent near Sodom. In chapter 13. In chapter 14, he's living in Sodom. Easy money comes with a high price. You cannot give your soul to the lusts of your eyes without losing the eyes of your soul. You will go blind in the soul when you give yourself to that which looks so good. And the reason is because Lot had no values in his heart. He had no sense of value to direct the possessions that he now possessed. He had no sense of value to consider what the implications were for his family. The fact of the matter is, Lot obviously enjoyed living among immoral people. Now, a lot of Christians are mixed up. We think that we can live in this world today and live away from immoral people. 1 Corinthians chapter 5, Paul writes and he says to the church in Corinth, now I did not mean when I told you not to associate with the immoral, and he has a long, complete, rather comprehensive list of those who fit into all these categories, and it's the same list that you and I could generate. I did not mean not to associate with the immoral of this world, for you would have to leave the world to do that. The problem is, when believers give themselves to the lusts of their eyes, our eyes, we move past the associations that we want to have for the sake of the gospel with immoral people. And we move into enjoying the lives of immoral people. And when we do that, we fall under the same disciplines they do. I had a fascinating experience this past week. Thursday was one of the best days I've had in years, literally. Literally. I went from morning till midnight and later because I went from here to Colorado Springs on Thursday, and I had a great meeting early in the morning, and I had a great time at La Madeleine's with one of our guys and another couple talking about ministry direction. And then I flew up and I got in touch with one of our recent graduates from the seminary. He had stood out in one course and she had stood out in another course, and they moved to Colorado Springs and they're living up there and they're starting a church out of thin air. Nobody, nothing. They're just going in. They settled into an apartment. They said, now God, what do we do? Doorbell rings, open it up, and here is the woman who is basically the maintenance person of this major apartment complex, who comes walking in, looks at a few things and says, why did you move to Colorado Springs? And they begin to tell her about their purpose of developing a church for Generation X people where they could come and relate. It's an X-rated church with an R-rated service. And this woman was sitting in their dining room, bisexual, trying to decide what she should do about Jesus Christ. You know, that couple is blown away by the stories they're getting. They have 20 people in their little circle they've attracted in 2 months. And they're blown away. 75% of them are in the media in Colorado Springs, advertising, television, radio. And they're blown away by these people who are not believers, who are living lifestyles that are unbelievable. But this couple, unlike Lot, are not attracted to it by the lusts of their eyes. They're not attracted to the lifestyle at all. They're attracted to the people by a heart of love for Jesus Christ. And one of the things we've got to understand, my friends, is this. As Christians, we can either be Lot or Abraham. But if you're attracted to money, power, pleasure, with no redemptive purpose, you will end up needing an Abraham to rescue you. That's exactly what happens, of course. Word gets to Abraham. Word comes to him. And we read that in verse 13, a fugitive came and told Abram, the Hebrew, the one who crosses over, sort of a mark of a man who's come from a far distance, crossing rivers and coming into this new territory. It's the first time the word is used of Abraham. Describes he was living by the oaks of Mamre down in the south central part of Israel. And he had the Amorite brother of Eshcol and the brother of Aner. And these were allies with him. He had had to make some kind of an arrangement to have permission to live in the land God had given him. He had to negotiate his part of the territory. That he had given Lot what Lot wanted and then negotiated a living space for himself. But they were allies. And so they come to war with him. And when he hears about this, he took out his trained men, born in his house, 318, and went to the north as far as Dan. That's the far north of Israel. And he divided his troops against them by night. You know, the fascinating thing is he had allies, he had resources, and he had wisdom in verse 15. He divided his troops, and this was probably a rear guard collection of people who were moving the prisoners and the goods for a long, long journey. And he divided, and he won. Verse 16, and he brought back all the goods and also brought back his relative Lot with his possessions and also the women and the people. Now we begin to see the real point of this chapter. Now we are moving toward the real lesson in this chapter. Once again in this chapter, we're going to see some more, another strange name and another strange event. We read in verse 17 that after his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings that were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him in the valley of Shaavah, that is down toward the south in Israel. But look at verse 18. Sodom comes out to meet him, and exactly at the same time comes along a man with a very strange name, Melchizedek, king of Salem. You know what that name means? It means the king of righteousness. Who is the king of peace. Salem means peace. Jerusalem was his city. He was the king of righteousness, who was the king of peace. The New Testament tells us that he's a picture of Jesus Christ. That he was both a priest and a king in his role. And what happened was this. Sodom comes along to meet Abraham because Abraham has goods and people. Sodom comes along to meet Abraham, and he's about to approach him with a fabulous deal. And the king of peace, who is the king of righteousness, comes along to meet Abraham, and he doesn't have a deal for him. He has a blessing for him. Look what happens. Verse 19, this man blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abram of God Most High." First time this name is used. God Most High. What does this mean? This means the one who is above all. This means the one who is superior to all. This means the one who is the greatest of all. And look at what else he says in the next line, possessor of heaven and earth. And immediately Melchizedek faces Abram with a choice. What are you going to do? Are you going to listen to the deal the king of Sodom has going to offer you? It's a good deal, by the way. And not only was it a good deal, Abram had earned it. It was very valid. He had every right to just keep everything he had gotten. And the king of Sodom wants to negotiate some kind of a deal to get back a little bit of what he had had. And along comes the king Melchizedek, king of righteousness, king of peace. And he says, "Blessed be Abram of the God Most High." That takes you right back to the promise God had made to Abram to bless him wherever he went and to give him this promised land. And at this point in time, Abram is faced with a choice. It's a choice you make every day. every day of your life you choose between Sodom and Melchizedek. Every day. Blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. This is perfect timing, because let me tell you where Abraham is. He is back at the same point of temptation in a different form that he was in Genesis 12, verse 10, when he got down to the Negev in the far south of Israel, and there was a famine in the land, and he owned no land, and he had to choose between staying and trusting God in the midst of the famine and going into Egypt and getting some kind of a great deal from Pharaoh. And he chose to go into Egypt and carve out the best deal he could and use deception and cleverness to get the wealth that he ended up possessing. And now along comes another king. And just then, God provides Abram with a choice. And the choice is between the offer of the king of Sodom, a good offer, a profitable offer, and a valid offer, and the offer of the king of righteousness, king of peace. Oh, very interesting. In the one instance, Abram is going to get. Watch. Watch what happens. At the end of verse 20, and he gave him a tenth of all. Isn't it fascinating that here is a chance to get, and here is a chance to give, and Abram chooses, as we're going to see in just a moment, not to get, but to give? That makes no sense. Except that Abram is practicing our third R. He's returned. He continues to realize the fact of the matter is his past sin is what got him into this risky situation. If Lot had not been involved, if Lot had never come with him, he'd have never faced this issue. The one decision Abram has made is he will not allow his past sin to be repeated and compound his future. You see, Abram has decided not to waste his pain. And here's our third R. Not just to return, and not just to realize, but remember to learn from your past sin. Remember to learn from your past sin. Don't waste your pain. Don't throw away that hurt and that grief and that struggle. Don't go back into that same pattern of shame. Don't waste your pain. Look at what Abraham does in verse 21. The king of Sodom said to Abram, "Give the people to me and take all the goods for yourself." This is his deal. Abram, you can make phenomenal wealth. You had taken all of the goods that some other kings had taken four powerful kings to get. You had taken it all back. And Abram said to the king of Sodom, "I have sworn to the Lord, God Most High." Picks up that very same word from Melchizedek. God Most High. And who is he? Possessor of heaven and earth. Why does he need Sodom to meet his needs? And he's got God who possesses everything. "I have sworn to the Lord God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth." He'd taken an oath. When? I don't know for sure. Maybe it was when he rebuilt that altar and came back and he said, "I will never do this again." At some point in time, he'd made that decision. "That I will not take a thread or a sandal thong or anything that is yours, lest you should say, 'I have made Abram rich.'" Maybe he decided it on the way back from battle. Maybe he said, "No, I'm not going to take a profit." Maybe there was a conversation. Maybe some of his men said, "Oh, general, boss, chief, look at how much you've gotten out of this. This is fabulous." And maybe in that moment he said, "No way. I will take nothing except what the young men have eaten and the share of the men who went with me, my three allies, Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre. Let them take their share." Don't waste your pain. Don't let Sodom attract you by the lust of the eyes to blind the light of your soul. Don't repeat past sin. Break the pattern. Stop it. Because the Lord Most High has the power to enable you to stop it, and He possesses all the resources that you need. Do not allow yourself to be caught in business with the king of Sodom. How can you tell when you should turn down a deal? How can you tell whether it's the king of Sodom or the king of righteousness who is speaking to you? That's what I want to talk about next week. But this week, don't waste your pain. Father, your word is full at times of strange names, strange places, and even strange events. But how much I personally am challenged by what I saw this week in this text. You are the possessor of heaven and earth. You are the God Most High, reigning above all else, fully capable of meeting every one of our needs. Oh Lord, help us never to respond to the king of Sodom. Help us always to seek that which is righteous and that which brings peace. For your glory and in your name.